Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato
Samma Sambuddhassa.
Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vija Charana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purissa Dhamma Sarati Sata Deva Manu Sanang Buddho Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditapo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Vakkasangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato Savakkasangho Samicipatipanno Bhagavato Savakkasangho Yadidang Chatari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savakkasangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anuttarang Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasa Namami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, pitying God, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
This is a very serious retreat. Okay, the questions. Dear Ajahn, it is very interesting to hear that there is no subconsciousness mind underneath, so to speak, underneath conscious mind moments. This makes sense, given that each of the six consciousnesses arise and pass constantly. How then are we to understand the idea of the latent defilements that you mentioned today? Did I mention? I don't know. Where do they hide? Please explain this from the perspective of Paticca Samuppada, if appropriate. Megha-metta and Megha-mudita and gratitude. Yeah, the idea of a subconscious is just trying to say there are some things that we don't allow to come up. But are they actually underneath the consciousness? Or are they just some things from the past? And that somehow we can, the word I use, like resonate with them. I just use something from, you know, science. You know, the signal from your mobile phone. You know, the message is maybe made all the way over in the other side of the country, maybe in Sydney, and they phone you here, but you can receive it. It's not inside your mobile phone. The mobile phone can literally resonate with someone turning on their mobile phone over in Sydney, and you can get the message. And that's very much like right now, you know, that you can, if you like, resonate, pick up signals from the past, and that's more like the subconscious. It's not sub in the sense of underneath this moment, but it's actually picking up signals from the past, which is one of the reasons why there comes a time in your meditation where you let go of the past. You don't own it. You don't feel proud of it, guilty of it. You don't use the past to define your personality and, you know, your sense of self. Who are you? How many degrees have you got from university? I remember some of those stuff which I did at university. If they gave me the same exam today, I'd fail for sure. So I do really, I deserve letters at the end of your name. Actually, I have got letters at the end of my name. Because I mentioned I got an MA from Cambridge and I got an AM, that's the Australian medal. Was it? Yeah. So I'm known as ma'am. And I remember that from years and years ago. They say anyone who's an earl, you know, those British peerages, big shots in Britain, and if they're an earl and they've also got an OBE, what does that make them? An earlobe. Sorry. So after a while, the idea of a subconscious, because we think we have to get hold of that, but if it's really subconscious, it doesn't really exist. What happens? Latent tendencies, if you like, that's just one way of looking at it, describing it. But if it was really latent, if it's underneath there somewhere, how can you get past it, get rid of it, or allow it to disappear? And after a while, some of those latent tendencies, what they call latent tendencies, they don't become latent at all. They're gone. Gone forever. And that's one of the parts of Buddhism which I always was fascinated about for many years, was the idea of the stream winner, the attainment of stream winning, and then you can never get reborn in the lower realms anymore. It's like a whole heap of past karma is jettisoned, it's untied, it's not part of you anymore, it's gone forever. How on earth can that happen? And the reason is because you don't own it. It's not part of your conscious baggage anymore. That conscious baggage, that's one of the reasons why that, you know, that if you look at Buddhism clearly, there are six different types of consciousness. And each one of those, you know, sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, smell, taste, body consciousness, you know, the sense of touch, and the mind consciousness. Each one of those are totally separate. They're individual, that's a difficult word, they're singular moments of experience. You can't have two at the same time. What happens is you hear something and you know you heard it. You can see something, I'm just scratching my eyelid, I can feel that scratch on my eyelid, and I know I scratched my eyelid. Afterwards, there's a time difference, and that time difference between one sense door and another sense door. And it happens so fast that some of the reasons why we think it's a continuous process with no gaps in it. And I once gave the simile of like looking at the beach. If you go to a nice sandy shore somewhere and look at the beach, from a distance it looks continuous, like a whole stretch of sand. But if you look closer, you find it's not a stretch of sand, it's individual particles of sand. And they're spaces between them. If you look with a microscope, there's huge spaces between them. A lot of the time, not even touching. But when you look from a distance, you can't see those gaps. But when you actually look at your process of awareness, what you're actually aware of, it changes every moment. And after a while, when you can understand what the mind consciousness is, that's the key, I explain it. When you understand what the mind consciousness is, then you can understand just what the other consciousnesses are. Be quiet, Joe Bob. And you find, because it happens quite fast, sight, mind, feeling mind. And then, hearing mind, mind. Different moments of consciousness, and if it goes so fast, it is very much like those old little machines. You flip the cards so quickly, and it appears like it's a person in motion. There's no gaps between them. When you watch a movie, you know, the movie just appears that it's continuous motion, but there's gaps between them. So after a while, you realize that this is just the illusion of the fast movement of the senses, and they're totally different sense experiences. So anyway, that means that you can't have two at the same time. Dear Ajahn, can meditation help with insomnia? I notice this quite a lot on meditation retreats. When people go to your room at night, it's hard to sleep. But when you come here, you fall asleep straight away when you start meditating. So what's the solution? The solution is, when you come here for the morning meditation, afternoon meditation, whatever meditation, come here and just pretend you're going to sleep. And then you'll be fully awake. When you go to your room at night time, pretend you're meditating. And then you fall asleep. Of course, that's a little bit of a joke, but there's still a lot of truth to that. Why is it that we find it difficult to fall asleep? Because we try to fall asleep. It's the trying which stops us relaxing enough to allow the body just to fall asleep. It's one of the reasons, well, it hasn't happened to me for quite a few years now, but some years ago I was finding it difficult to fall asleep at night. So what I decided to do, I started to change my perceptions. And I started to think and perceive, when I lay down on a bed, now the beds over here are just amazing. It's really thick. You've seen my cave, it's just a mattress there, it's not that thick. But it's still really comfortable. It's the most comfortable position I ever get into. You know, in just to lay down, nice soft mattress, a beautiful pillow, a nice blanket if you need one, you're laying down there. And it's just the most comfortable posture of the day. Think of your bed right now. So comfortable. You can stretch out, no sores anywhere. The lovely pillow snuggled into your pillow. And I decided it was so pleasant to actually to lay down in a bed. Well, I didn't want to miss that experience. You know, as a monk, you have to sit and do all sorts of stuff, which is sometimes unpleasant and tiring, but in a bed it was a wonderful experience. Why do I want to waste that by going to sleep? So I decided I don't want to go to sleep. When I lay in a bed, I'm just going to enjoy just relaxing, stretching out, snuggling into the pillow, and just laying there perfectly clear aware. I don't want to go to sleep. And of course, that's when I went to sleep. Had a nice night's sleep. You realize when you want to, you can't. But when you don't want to, you're just at peace with things. Then the body can relax. There was this one psychologist, I remember, I give lectures and conferences all over the place. And this particular conference was the ABCAP over in Sydney, Australian Association of Buddhist Counselors and Psychotherapists. And it was run or started by Eng Chai, he's a good friend. And I know that there was one monk who lives in Sydney, who used to live here, who was, he called it Madcap. You know what that was. Not saying anything, yeah. But they do a lot of good work. But anyway, this lady, that's one of the talks which she gave, that she started this, her psychology company is called like sleeplikeababy.com. sleeplikeababy.com, and had a website, and she said it was teaching little sweeping the body meditation, that's all. Just like, you know, you teach here all the time, just, you know, go through your legs, your feet first of all, just feel all the sensation. If there's anything which needs to be relaxed, be kind to it, just relax it to the max. And go to the heels of your feet and the ankles and up the calves. I better stop because it's late at night and maybe you might go to sleep and stop listening to my talk. So, but anyway, they sweep their attention through the body, and before they even got to their torso, they were fast asleep. And the reason was they weren't trying to go to sleep, they weren't worrying about it, they were becoming aware of their body and relaxing it. And actually, that's how it works. So if ever, you know, you have trouble with insomnia, don't try and cure it. Just learn how to relax your body more and take your attention away from the mind and thinking and start feeling instead. So meditation help with insomnia? Sure it can. How important is posture during meditation seated? It's not important at all. As long as you're comfortable. Everybody's got a different posture. And sometimes, you know, you ask yourself, is this a comfortable posture for you today? We have chairs And sometimes you look at those chairs, the backrests are inclined. I think it's supposed to be about 15 degrees from the vertical. And apparently that, physiotherapist, I was thinking, which therapist is it? It's not psychotherapist. It's just physiotherapist. Say, no, that's the most comfortable angle for your back, just in general. So sometimes if you lean back against the chair, you feel really comfortable. Why do you always have to sit up straight? So sometimes you can try that, you can experiment. For me, I just sat up straight like this most of my life as a monk, so I'm comfortable like this. But every posture, every person is totally different. You try and get the best posture which is comfortable for you. You can try just cross-legged on the floor. You can, as some people do, you put your legs out. Is anyone doing that here? No, it's quite okay. You know that people say you shouldn't point your feet at the Buddha or at the monks or the nuns. But nevertheless, people have been pointing their feet at the Buddha and the monks and the nuns for years, especially the Buddha. The Buddha's never complained. And I say that because as long as you're not doing it out of disrespect, you're just doing that out of comfort for your own body, fine. Get the body sort of at ease. And that's the most important part of the posture. Sometimes, though, with postures, I haven't talked about this yet, and it's a fascinating part of meditation. A good example is this one meditation years ago in North Perth. Actually, somebody tapped me on the shoulder during the meditation. And I said, look at that lady over there. And my goodness, she was really contorted. She was twisted all over. If I did that now, you'd have to take me to hospital. But like this, and just exaggerate that two or three times, she was really bent over and twisted. We were concerned about her. And so I waited, you know, until she came out of her meditation, took her aside and said, did you realize just the position you were in? She said, no, I was just meditating. And then, of course, I started to get the picture. I said, how do you feel now? She said, she feels wonderful. No aches, no pains. She said, no. And then the next question was, when did you have your car accident? How do you know that, Ajahn Brahm? I never told anybody that. You have got psychic powers, it's proven. You've read my mind. She overreacted and I said, look, you were really twisted when you were meditating. But you feel so at ease in your body right now. There must have been some injury you had. And the car accidents are the most common. And I said, you know, your body, when you got out of the way, your body decided to give a bit of healing to itself. It twisted around to allow energies to flow which were blocked before. That's one way of describing it, but it's pretty accurate. This other lady, you know, she complained to me that when she was meditating, that her neck and shoulders were really hot. Not the rest of her body, but just that part. So what's going on? And my answer is, when did you have your whiplash? A car injury. How did you know that? I just deducing. Because the hot part of the body was the body doing some healing. And you can't do that if you do it on purpose, consciously. You have to have totally let go, and the body does it by itself. It's like the body thinks, oh, he's out of the way, she's out of the way. Now I can just do what I really want to do, to give some healing to that part of the body. It's fantastic when those sorts of things happen. So sometimes you can start with a posture where you feel reasonably comfortable and ask your body, are you comfortable like that? That's like being mindful of your body. It's just a technique of making sure you're aware of what the body's feeling. Do you want to be like this right now? Are you okay, body? And let your body decide. If you want to adjust the posture, you move this way or you move that way, then ask your body, do you feel better? If it says no, then go back to where you started. Little by little, you become very aware of your own body and you can adjust it so it can really relax. When it does, the body is so nice and peaceful, it disappears. You can't feel it. And then that's when these amazing experiences like heat in the body, or the body just twists around all by itself. And you don't do it. Now, I mentioned earlier, for years, you know, in Thailand as a young monk, my body was bent over because of sloth and torpor. And I told you the solution was just to be aware as much as you can, but don't do anything, just be kind. And then, I do remember many times you were bent over, but you were aware enough to notice the body just straighten up. But the weird thing was, it did it all by itself. I never gave it any orders at all. It just straightened without me commanding it to. And I realized just how wise this body is. Much of what your body does is automatic. The heartbeat, the lungs, you know, everything else is just automatic. So what about your posture? Your posture can be automatic too. It feels good. So the one important part of your posture, which I think is the most crucial part of it, is the posture of your mouth. To be able to smile. And I think I told you that, just the experience when I was in Cambridge, got to be going, I got tricked. I say this and it's true. Tricked into joining the boat club. That was really hard work, you know, pulling an oar, getting the boat to go forward. But I remember the coach just shouting at me from the towpath, "You're making an ugly face. Smile." And I did. I smiled. Because I was always, you know, wondering, what's he on about? And as soon as I smiled, then I had more energy, significantly more energy, and the oar was easier to pull. It was weird. Whatever you're doing, please smile. Then you find you have more energy and it's actually all easier to do. So if ever you're getting a bit fed up with your meditation, take your awareness away from your breath or your whatever you're watching and put it on your mouth. Make a smile. You can't make one, fake one. And you find you get some happiness in your mind. And sometimes that's all it needs to break that sort of blockage and get a bit of happiness, joy in there. And then the meditation takes off. Thank you for this lovely retreat. The best is yet to come. You know, that's one of the reasons why I used to go to these retreats and see all the photographs of the retreatants. They all look really happy. Because the photographs were always taken at the end of the retreat. They were all happy because now they could go home. So if you do any photographs, you have to do it, you know, before, in the middle of the retreat. That's more honest. I would just like to know what happens in order, disappearance, jhanas, wisdom. Oh, in the order. Yeah, when many things disappear, then as jhanas happen. And after the jhanas happen, you can't get wisdom within a jhana. The jhana is just too refined and still. But after the jhana you emerge from the jhana, that is when you have a lot of power. And a lot of... For example, I mentioned one of those. You can ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? And when you ask yourself, what's my earliest memory, you just ask it once, and if your mind is still enough, you get these early memories either of your childhood, your babyhood, or in your mum's womb, or beforehand. And I will give a little word of advice there, though. Sometimes people on these retreats did that, and they said, please don't ask us ever to do that again, because what they got was their death experience in their last life. All you need to do, if it's something unpleasant, just say earlier, please. And then you go before your death in the past life. And of course, like, dying is unpleasant, and it's one of the strongest and closest of the mind's memories to this life. You know, when you died before. So that's one of the reasons. Always remember, you can always say earlier, please, and get something more interesting and less unpleasant. So, in order, disappearance, jhana, wisdom. His disappearance happens, then jhana, then wisdom. You've got it in the right order. Is everyone a crooked tree, including arahats? Yes. Or is it just unenlightened people? On the outside, we look imperfect. That's one of the reasons why be careful. You know, sometimes you look at, you know, some nuns, some monks. Do you really know who's enlightened and who's not? Because they disappear. You know, the sense of ego and self goes. You can know who's not enlightened, that's easy. But who's not is hard to find. So, a crooked tree, that's just how people appear. And what's wrong with a crooked tree? That's why there's some of the tales. Because I was in China for so many years, some of the tales about enlightened monks, who is enlightened and who's not. And sometimes it's very hard to tell. They sit very peacefully, they don't really say very much. It's only when you get close to them you can find out which is the real McCoy and which is just faking it. But anyway, they look like crooked trees. Who's the most crooked tree? The most twisted. I have a question which is always coming to mind. It can't always be coming to mind. It repeatedly comes to mind. Okay. Anyway, I try my best to make it interesting. There are stray thoughts coming from nowhere. Aha! That's a good question. Do they really come from nowhere? Or do you concoct them? Now, some of these thoughts, I thought, where did that one come from? It came from nowhere. I didn't think that. Well, I didn't originate that. When you get more mindful, you find, yes, you did. You made it up to try and disturb yourself. You didn't see the creating of it. It's as if stillness is threatening to us. When we're really still, we can't do anything. That's one of the reasons we have our alarm systems. And one of the most subtle of our alarm systems is our hearing. And if we turned all the lights off in this room, then of course you could still feel things, but the main defense of your personal, what you think your safety, is hearing. So if we turn all the lights off and I went, ooh, ooh. And it's the bells which actually make us awake, the gong which we ring to get you out of meditation, say it's breakfast time. It's sound is what penetrates the deep meditations. That's one of the reasons. Why is that? And it is because that is our defense system. We listen. But sometimes that defense system can be very deceitful. Because I remember one of my stories, sitting out in the jungle in Thailand. And it was really quiet, peaceful, and my little mosquito net umbrella. And the jungles in Thailand are very noisy, you know, for the first hour after sunset, but then they sort of settle down a bit. So I was sitting there, I'd already got peaceful, but then I heard something walking towards me. It was in the jungle, a jungle animal. And of course I just, you know, I was relaxed. I listened very carefully and thought, oh, it's only a small animal. So, well, it's not dangerous. It was coming in my direction, but only a small one. probably maybe a mouse deer or something. But then, as it came closer, I could hear it louder. So it was, you can see, it was crunching the leaves underneath its feet or whatever it was, and it was breaking some twigs. And I thought, this is actually not just a small animal, it's a medium-sized one. Like, remember the civet cats in the jungle? They're just benign, but no, they were just about this big. And then I thought, still, not a problem. And then as it came closer, you could tell by the sound it was making, it was not a small animal. It was quite a big one. Because it needed weight to, you know, crunch some of these bigger sticks on the forest floor. And so I got scared. And I had a flashlight. And so I turned on the flashlight, looking for, this was like a tiger or a bear or something. I know my teacher, Ajahn Chah, said, the tigers, they will never eat monks. I said, how do you know? If they did eat a monk, he wouldn't say, and the tiger wouldn't confess. So you were a bit scared there. So I looked out, looking for the tiger and come in my direction. I looked, I couldn't see it at first, but then I actually saw it. A little mouse about this big. And what it taught me was fear makes a mouse sound like a tiger. It's weird what fear does in the dark. And that's why you can't trust those sounds. They amplify things. So little by little, but you know that is that sense which has been developed in your body to protect you. And that's why that is what is hard to let go of. Anyway, the thoughts which you say come from nowhere, I find reasons for other thoughts. The stray thoughts have no origin, and I can't find any dependent origination in them. What is the principle behind them? It's just, you know, you want to look for a thought. It's like I said the other day, in the old days when I was a lay person, you'd have the TV, and you look, see if there's anything on the TV. You know, in those days there was only two channels, BBC and ITV, and we always had wars in our house about what we were going to watch. I don't know how you manage it with, how many channels have you got these days? And you got sort of net, 100. Sorry?
100.
100, yeah. Yeah, and you got the internet channels and goodness knows what else.
Yeah.
1,000. But what do? You just look for something to distract yourself. You actually search, you know, your memory of thoughts or make some new ones based on the old ones, but they're basically all the same. Anything to distract yourself. Something to do. You don't need to. And that's the reason why. So once you actually define those thoughts, they're not useful. You get bored with them soon, like any thing you watch on the TV or something. That's one of the reasons why our college cinema club, they have clubs for everything, but they had the films they were showing the next term. And they had, the first film I think was Zulu, Sex and Violence in South Africa. Then they had some other film, Sex and Violence in LA. Some other film, Sex and Violence in Edinburgh or something. And we thought, you know, that's actually a pretty accurate description of the movies. That's one of the reasons why, when I was told that someone had spotted Sarah Jessica Parker, is that it? She's a film actress, yeah. Sex and the City or something. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. How do you know? Okay. But anyway, someone saw her in a coffee shop somewhere reading a copy of my book, you know, Opening the Door of Your Heart.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, sort of cool, but then I thought, hey, if she's reading a copy of my book, then I'll soon get the invite to do a cameo on Sex and the City. But if I did a cameo on Sex and the City, what could... Isn't that kind of any sex as a monk? So it would be meditation and the monastery. I don't think that would sell. I don't think you get permission to get me on a cameo there. Because you're not sexy, it's not the city. Sorry?
She might go on a retreat, Sex and the City in the monastery.
Take all the rules, I don't know. But anyway, she never called. But sometimes we just need to think about something, because not thinking, silence and quietness is quite challenging. An example of that, I remember just when we first opened Bodhinyana Monastery about 39 years ago, people would come in and they'd start talking more loudly than they'd usually talk. And I couldn't understand why. You didn't need to talk loud. You can still hear very clearly. And I think it was because the silence challenged them. They didn't feel comfortable, you know, when there was no noise around. Why do you have, you know, the Muzak in the shopping centres or in the elevators or something? Sometimes people don't like silence. That's one of the reasons why we make up thoughts, because we're not at ease with silence. Just a suggestion. Dear Ajahn, have you experienced full enlightenment like the Buddha did? If so, when did this occur? Is it only during meditation or does it stay with you? Thanks so much. Okay, I wasn't going to say this evening, but I'll tell you the story of when I became enlightened. Are you interested? You've heard it before, haven't you? But this was my 6th rains retreat. And my meditation was really strong. And, no, my fourth rains retreat. And it was a very peaceful monastery, nothing much to do, no responsibilities. You meditate, walk meditation. You know, some evenings your mind is really peaceful, so you just keep on meditating. And I was doing my walking meditation, it just got so incredibly peaceful, and you know, you're really hitting the spot. And all these great insights came. It was like 11, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning. And then the big one came. It's incredible insight. Wow. And I was just walking there, just no tiredness at all. Peaceful, beautiful, no problems ever again. Enlightened, full. And then I just went and sat, so much bliss. And then I thought, the bell goes at 3 o'clock, so I better have a rest, I thought. So I went back to my hut, lay down. Couldn't go to sleep, 5-10 minutes, that's all. I got up, went to the hall, and started meditating. And it's mentioned to you, this was in northeast Thailand, it's very, very humid. And so, you know, these conditions are not really conducive to meditation. But then before 3 o'clock, it was about 2:30 or 2:15, it was so easy to get a good posture. My mind was just so peaceful and so strong. And when the bell went, the 3 o'clock bell, I was sitting there just blissing out. And then we did the chanting. And when we did the chanting, usually, you know, in Thai, it's just really very dull. This morning, yo, soba! I had so much energy, I could not chant softly, really giving it full power. And then we went on the alms round. All the people, these little villagers who were giving you alms food, they were just actually usually little bits of rice, and no sticky rice. And as soon as they put a little bit of sticky rice in the new arahat's bowl, I was blasting them with loving kindness. You don't know how lucky you are. And then when I finished my arms out, I got back to the monastery. I was just spreading loving kindness, so powerful to everything. And then I saw something strange. Usually in that monastery, it's remote, it's usually just one saucepan of curry. And it's always the same every day. It was rotten fish curry. And they used to catch the fish in the rains retreat and put it in jars. And it just got pickled itself, and just that's what you ate. Rotten fish curry. And it was really stank. Please excuse me. Once I was cleaning up around the monastery, and I found one of the jars they put in. They just put the little fish in the jar and put a piece of plastic on the top. The plastic had been broken. And so the rotten fish were just crawling with maggots. And I went to throw it away. And the headman of the village, the most educated and refined, said, "What are you doing? Look, I mean, this is the rotten fish, the plardek. It's got infested with maggots." He said, "No, that's extra protein." And that's what we ate the next day. It was disgusting. Especially for Westerners. Even the Thai people didn't want to go up there and eat that stuff. So anyway, but that morning, it was weird. There was another pot there. And that pot, I used to be a vegetarian before, but there was no vegetarian food or anything vegetarian there. So the other pot was a pork curry. And that was actually just edible. And it's the first time I'd seen that for weeks. And I thought straight away, the heavenly beings were celebrating the new monk's enlightenment. And I thought, wow, even the heavenly beings can understand this. And so then it came down to actually, we used to pass the food down. And so the head monk there, I was number two in the line, the head monk, he just poured about three or four whopping big ladles of the pork curry into his bowl. And none of the rotten fish curry. He was a local boy. He grew up on this rotten fish curry. He should like it. But it doesn't matter. There was lots of pork curry left for me. And then what he did next? He took the pork curry, which he just, taken about half of, there's plenty left. And then he said, it's all the same, and poured the two together and stirred them all up. Yeah, exactly, that's how I felt. Actually, much worse. And I said, if he thinks it's all the same, why didn't he mix them up before he took his? That's really hypocrite. And that is when I realized arahats don't worry about what they eat. I wasn't an arahat after all. And no, if you think you're enlightened and you find out you're not, that's really depressing. Honestly, it's the most depressed I probably was ever. I didn't mind what I ate then, I just stopped in my blood, I don't care. You pass it. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to actually say this, because sometimes you've got to be careful with insights and claims of enlightenment or whatever. I really thought I was, but I was just so stupid, and certainly it wasn't. What happens is you have to wait and just see what happens later on. And a lot of time it's like you're blowing up these defilements, and then you have to wait for the dust to settle to see what defilements are left. Then later on you might be able to find out. It's good experience for me to show how tricky this mind can be. Anyway, when I got in line. It was very nice, it only lasted a few hours. So anyway, because it wasn't really enlightenment anyway. Could you please explain how the samadhi experience gets turned on to clear seeing, knowledge, vipassana? Thank you, Ajahn, for the marvellous teaching, Sadhu Time Sri. It's how it happens. Why is it we can't see things as they really are? Now, because there are some things which are just too obnoxious to see. Okay, I wasn't going to say this on this retreat, but I always say it anyway, so here it comes again. Nice meditation here in this hall a few years ago, and I had to go to the toilet. Those of you who haven't heard this one before, it's absolutely true. personal experience, I know this and I don't add to it, to do a number two. It was in the middle toilet of the men's section opposite the laundry. We should have a sort of a heritage listing on that toilet. This is where it happened. They're just in that ordinary, just sitting down there, just letting go. And I made the mistake that after doing my business, I had a look. Honestly, just, that was such a beautiful piece of feces. One of the most, probably one of the most amazing ones I've ever laid in a toilet bowl. Next time you go, have a look. I say, your mind was so still and peaceful. Whatever it saw, it's just so beautiful to see a world in a grain of sand. It was like that. And I just, the colours. Okay, I won't keep going. And the shape. And then the, you won't call it the smell, the aroma, the fragrance. Look, honestly, some of the aromas which people put on their face and their scents and perfumes and stuff, that's so fake. But the smell of your feces, I mean, that is earthy. That's real. That's got something about it which is just not superficial. Next time you go there, have a smell. Why is it that we consider it to be repulsive? So when your mind becomes clear, you can see things you never expected to see. You see beauty in just a piece of what most people say is impossible to see beauty in. Well, that happened. And that gave the insight, what is beauty? What is things which are delightful or things which are repellent? You just totally uncalibrate, not recalibrate, what you think is delightful and what is undelightful. You can see beauty in so many things, which means that, you know, you're challenging your old perceptions, seeing things anew, and that frees you from a lot of the defilements. So the samadhi experience allows you to see things differently, surprises you. Another example of that was just having some nice meditation in Thailand, and then just walking past the, you know, what was the well, and that's where we would bathe and do our washing. And I saw a towel on the line, just drying in the sunshine. It was black, no, really like coal black towel. I've never seen one like that before anywhere. Towels, and they may be blue or yellow or green or all sorts of colours. White is very common. Have you ever seen a black towel? No, I've never seen one like that. They just don't sell them. And there was one, clear to the eyes, on the line. So I stopped and paused and just stared. What on earth is this? Who does this belong to? A jet black towel. And then while I was staring at 5 or 6, 7 minutes, then it changed back to white. It was a white towel all along. Your perception has been allowed to see it in a totally different way. I wasn't taking any drugs, I wasn't going crazy, I just had nice meditation. And you started seeing the Buddha saying things like that. Sometimes at night time it's like daytime. Sometimes at daytime it looks like it's dark. So what happens when the mind gets very strong? It can play around and show you just how uncertain perception is. I love that sort of stuff, because it challenges the way that I've been programmed to perceive and think. So clear seeing knowledge, when it's clear seeing, you know, you're seeing things in a totally fresh way, and it frees you. Emotional intelligence, heart and mind. Though most universities have this as a subject, full of theories and models and assumptions, as you said. Is it? Okay. Just to start with one. Yeah. Buddha is the father of emotional intelligence. Oh, yeah. It's subject, content, empathy, self-esteem, self-awareness, conflict resolution, communication, etc., are derived from Buddhism. You very simply explained it in the last couple of days, how these concepts link derived from Buddhism. I learned has to link them without harming to any religious mindsets, using more practical, user-friendly manner. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for enhancing my understanding of these connections. Buddhism is the father of emotional intelligence. I think one of the things you're saying there is, you know, who invented these things? Did the Buddha invent these things? Did he discover them? Or as I like reading in some of these suttas, he discovered an old path which had been grown over. He didn't reinvent them. This is a natural truth which is always there, whether Buddhas exist or not. But to point them out, you have to experience them. Once you experience them, it's like you're clearing the path again. And emotional intelligence, sometimes it's wonderful to see that. You don't need to be emotional, brain smart to be wise. Some of the wisest people I've met, the kindest people, I'm sure you know that, kindest people you meet, haven't probably even been to university. Maybe didn't finish school. They're so kind. And they can teach us a lot. There was this lady years ago who got a job, I think she finished one job, and she got a job, volunteered for some, you know, for overseas aid work or something. And she got a job over in Africa, in one of the camps which were helping some people who were starving. I mean, really starving. And the job she was given was, one of the jobs, was to go outside every morning, outside the protected area. She had a number, maybe 60 or 70, and that's all the people she could allow in that day, because they only had a certain amount of food, medicine, clothing, whatever. And she couldn't allow in 62 if the number was 60. And there was no hundreds outside. And she said that it really inspired her. All these people, they didn't rush in and, you know, try and get in, because they knew that most of them would never get in. They said, no, take her. Take him. They were just so selfless. And she said she was so inspired by that experience, how people look after each other and they care for each other and they won't be selfish. She says, no, not me, not, don't take me, take him, to give them life. And those people who didn't get in would be dead by the following morning. And she did that for weeks and weeks and weeks. When she told that story, you know, people said that was a terrible experience. She said, no, it wasn't, it was inspiring. Just to see how human beings can care for one another and not be so selfish when it really is life and death. And then they asked, what are you working at now? He said, I'm working in the UK government civil service. Now that's depressing. And not the way that was said, because you see that we always think that, you know, what is beautiful, emotional intelligence, when you actually see it, it's a gorgeous, inspiring. Anyway, suddenly one day I started to experience severe anxiety attacks. This has created a sense of loss of myself, loss of meaning in life. My job was very fulfilling. Suddenly I lost meaning. What's happening, Ajahn? Ah, I lost the... what is it? I lost the pound or whatever. Lost the ground. Okay. Suddenly when you have anxiety attacks, this lady, she's a son of a... son, she's a son. It's a daughter of one of the strong Thai supporters here in Perth. And she was a very smart girl. And she was doing a dentistry degree over in Adelaide University. And she had these anxiety attacks and came out from nowhere. And she was so, she had, you know, the best doctors, three doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever, but nothing was working. She was bedbound. She'd been in the bed in her student flat for a long time. And then nothing was working. And so her uncle so said, I'll call Ajahn Brahm, see if he can give you a hand. And so I, you know, she, the guy, the uncle called me and I sort of called her. She was in bed. And he was doing a range retreat, so I couldn't actually go over or do anything else except phone calls. And I asked her, what's happening? She said she had such bad anxiety she couldn't even leave her bedroom. And then I asked her, how does it feel? What do you mean? It's terrible. No, how does it feel? And where do you feel it? Actually, I think I asked where you feel it, first of all. Because every emotion has a corresponding physical manifestation. And she said, I feel it in my chest. Where? Describe it to me. Where is this? Around my chest. And I said, I'm going to give you a call back in three days. I want you to give me a description, in centimetres and millimetres from your navel, your belly button. Where is the anxiety, the tension in your stomach or your chest felt? You know, is it sort of even around the centre of your chest? Does it extend more one way than the other way? Where is it located? I gave her something to do. Because sometimes to get some clarity about this, if someone tells you what to do, it's never as good as you find the meaning and reasons for yourselves. You take control, no, control isn't the wrong word, you take sort of responsibility for the treatment. So she felt the area, and 3 days later, she was a really smart lady, and she described how it felt, or where it felt. The next thing I said, well, what does it feel like? I want a clear description of the feelings. Is it all the same all over the area, or it's hot, or it's aching, or it's pulsing? When you have an anxiety attack, how does it feel? And 3 days later, she called again and gave this amazing description of how her anxiety attacks felt to her on her body. And said, the next thing to do, he said, oh, when you have those anxiety attacks, now you know it, you know where it is, now please massage that area. And the nice thing about this was, she said, well, sometimes she's a bit too tired and hasn't got any energy. But she had a boyfriend. And the boyfriend was a live-in boyfriend who had washed for her, cleaned for her, and looked after her. And the boyfriend, I said, well, get him to do it, to massage you. That's what boyfriends are for. Well, they're more than that. But they did that. Give us a call in 3 days. And after the 3 days, 9 days since she started calling me, he said, well, what's happening? I said, well, no, I feel it, I know where it is. And so I just massage it. I'll get my boyfriend to massage it. And he said, well, what happens after you massage it? And then she said, well, you know, the body relaxes. I can't feel the pressure, the burning in my chest anymore. And then I said, what happens to the anxiety? I always remember this moment, because this was like the Eureka moment. She paused. And then she said, and the anxiety went as well. She said, now you know how to deal with your anxiety. I hung up. And then a few days later, she was out of bed. Every time she has an attack, she would massage the area of the chest mindfully and kindly. And the physical manifestation disappeared, and so did the cause, the anxiety itself. And she was soon back at lectures. She graduated first class honours. And she married her boyfriend in the Sunken Gardens over in UWA. And she demanded that I be the one who gives the marriage blessing to them. And she also she nominated me. Anyone can nominate anyone for Australian of the Year. She nominated me. Of course, I never got it. I didn't worry about that. It was nice. She felt so grateful for saving her life. Wonderful that I could do the marriage ceremony. Now she's got two kids, two boys. And they came the other day, I think, about a week ago, the boys. And it's nice actually to see just how a little bit of kindfulness could overcome what was actually killing her. So that's when you experience severe anxiety attacks. Find out where it's felt in the body. Get to know it. And massage it. Is it possible to briefly explain what is different between each jhana? Is it basically that each time is deeper and more delightful, more beautiful? Yeah. And how is a nimitta felt? A nimitta is also blissful. But it's different types of bliss. It's like ice creams with different flavours. Each one, next one is more delicious. The first one is the bliss because your five senses have gone for a long while. You're free of them. Now you know those five sense consciousnesses are a burden. You bliss out on those. The second one is, jhana, briefly, is because your will has gone. It's not your will, yours anyway. It's like a guard who always doesn't allow you to sleep, doesn't allow you to do anything except what your will wants you to do, always critical of you, you're never good enough. And that will is a burden. It's so irritating. The will's gone. You can't win anything. You're just there, totally still and peaceful in your mind. And that's blissful, believe it or not. And the second one is one of the reasons for joy, well, not reasons for joy, the piti. That type of joy, a coarser form of happiness, has disappeared. You've just got the sukha. And the last one is you've got this contentment. The fourth jhana. Sometimes people call it equanimity. These days I prefer calling it contentment. It's not sort of, you know, that you don't feel anything. You feel incredible bliss. The bliss of contentment. The Buddha said, upeka sukha. Happy contentment. And that's the Buddha said, almost the purity of mindfulness. You can't be more mindful than that. Those are the four jhanas. That's just a brief explanation. When you get there, you know, and you experience those things, wow, you come out afterwards and, oh no, I get to understand what's going on. How to make peace with anxiety? Just massage it. When I sleep, sometimes I often dream about my boss scolding that the job wasn't done right. Our bosses always do that. Except the bosses at Bodhinyana Monastery. Is that correct? You better say yes, otherwise I'll scold you. No, honestly, just, you know, do the massage on your body, because every one of those emotions has a corresponding physical manifestation. You massage it and it just goes away. Can you please let us know the 12 factors and explain the meaning of it? The 12 factors of what? Paticcasamuppada. Oh my goodness me. That's awesome. Okay. You can read that in a book. And I say that because sometimes I remember just going to conferences and they said they appreciated what I taught at conferences simply because it's not what they can read in a book. If you read it in a book, that's the best way of doing it. But the 12 factors, it's okay, in brief, delusion, will, rebirth consciousness, and then we get rebirth consciousness, nama rupa, the objects of consciousness, if you like. Then the six sense faculties, the vedana, I missed one out somewhere, okay. Contact, and then vedana, and then you've got craving, desire, then you have attachment, no attachment, yeah. You have fuel, I prefer upadana, taking up. And then you've got bhava, existence, or planes of existence, places to get reborn into, and then you've got birth, then you get old age, suffering and death. It's more than that, isn't it? I missed one out. That's close enough. If you want to know them by experience, then wait till you die, and then you'll know all of the lot of them. For your own personal experience. What about the Indians who can stand on one leg for long hours or can predict one's future, etc.? Do they practice the four jhanas? I know that some people have only got one leg, but if you've got two, stand on two. Or sit down, that's what chairs are for. Can they predict the future? Never trust a poor fortune teller. If they can't predict their own fortune, how on earth can they predict yours? There's a lot of wisdom in that. Have a look at fortune tellers. You know, they're so poor, and they think they've got the wisdom. If they were really wise, they predict their own fortune. They predict the lottery numbers, and they just buy the lottery numbers. They wouldn't need to work anymore. Can you share us some good examples of emotional intelligence? Ajahn Brahm, when you'll be teaching us how to combine loving kindness and best meditation? Did you get the answer there? Emotional intelligence is sometimes really realizing you haven't got time to do things. So you don't say no because people don't understand that. You just put the question on the ground. That was an emotionally intelligent answer. Where will you be teaching us how to combine loving kindness and breath in meditation together? Can you do a guided combined meditation, please? Probably next year. That's what you said. When will you be teaching? So I gave the answer. I'm over time already, so. How does someone build kindness within oneself for others' kindness? It's when you get more mindful and you see what kindness is and how beneficial it is. What a wonderful thing that is. And it's joyful, and you're inclined towards it more and more. That's how you build it. I have been not thinking all week, so I need some help with my grammar. Somebody sent me a cartoon about one, the senior monk was praising his disciple monk, saying, "You are the most thoughtless monk in the whole monastery." Well done. Have you been thoughtless? Was he? That's pretty thoughtless. What about the nuns? Have you been thoughtless? That's one of the reasons I also... I celebrate losers. Be the greatest loser. Who was the greatest loser? The Buddha lost everything. So be a great loser. Don't be a winner. I have been not thinking all week, so I need some help with my grammar. What is the difference between freedom of desires and freedom from desires? Freedom of desires is when you can do whatever you want, whenever you want. In other words, you have whatever you desire, it's your right to have that desire. And freedom from desires, you don't have any desires in the first place. Now just the example, just having, after this retreat, $1 billion. Congratulations, you've won the best meditator prize. $1 billion. Would you like that? Or would you prefer to be enlightened? Have no desires at all, you don't need any desires. Which would you prefer? If you say $1 billion, that's before tax. The BSW has to pay, has to take the tax. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you mentioned being kind to the body is important. How do we get to the balance of being kind yet not attaching to it? Attaching to it is it's not kind. No, you don't attach to things. If you attach to your urine, that's not being kind to it. You let it go. That's being kind to your body. You give it a good rest. So attachment is not being kind. I looked at the Buddha statue inside the stupa. In his meditation, certain fingers touch certain fingers, and right hand thumb touches the middle finger. Right hand ring finger touches left and middle finger. Is there any significance to this? No. Are we wasting time? But be careful, because in the big Borobudur monument, you know what the myth is. That if you touch, if you can actually reach and touch the Buddha statue inside, don't do that, please. But if you can do that and you do it, you will find true love. And if your wife sees you doing that, you're in big trouble. Well, if any nuns or monks do that, you're... But real true love is not on another person. True love of, like, things worthy of loving. Peace, freedom, stillness, disappearance. I have about 10 questions and probably 100 after that, so my question is, how do I find a solution to my own problems? Delegate. Why are they your problems? If you own them, then they'll keep on multiplying. If you realize you don't own any problems, they're not yours, they're just problems. And don't give them too much significance, and they'll pass away. The conditions in Thailand sound so tough for a young monk. Oh yeah, they were terrible. Are you who gave up your reasonable, comfortable life in the West? Oh yeah. What motivated you to keep going? On the outside it may look like it was tough, but on the inside it was inspiring and peaceful. It was really simple. And you saw all the... One of the things I remember seeing, I got through quite a lot of those questions, that's good, I could tell the story. One of the things I remember seeing the first year is going into the local village as a monk to actually to do a ceremony for somebody blessing a house or a marriage or something. And you go walking in there at night time and you see the houses are on stilts and they have sort of the wooden floor. And then a whole family, maybe about 15, 16, 18 of people, grandparents, uncles, aunties, brothers, sisters, you know, the families and the kids. And there were no electricity. So all they had was a bowl of oil, and they used a toothpaste tube, you know, the top of it they cut off. They put a rag through the hole where usually the toothpaste comes out, and that was floating in the oil, and they just lit the top. And it was smoky light, but the smoke kept the mosquitoes away. And they would sit around that light, just telling funny stories, sometimes the same stories, every night, together. When I saw that, I realized what I missed out in my childhood. The whole family lived together. And they just, every evening, instead of doing homework or watching TV, they would just sit together and tell stories. Some were fake, I'm sure. Some were real. I remember one of the stories, Ajahn Chah's favorite story when he was young. It was when this... I don't know if it really worked. Oh, yes, right, I think this works. A burglar went into one of the houses when the family were out there just doing their fields. So, you know, he climbed up. And when he actually got inside, he saw this bowl of these, they're called Samoa. They're laxatives. I remember having those. I didn't know what they were. You could have them in the evening. I thought, oh, well, I'm a bit hungry. Give it a try. Never again. They're very strong laxatives. So, you know, the burglar took a few of those and they acted pretty quickly, but he was about to go down to evacuate himself when he saw the owner of the house coming up. So he knew he was in big trouble. So he climbed up into the loft area, and it was quite dark up there, so if you're down below, you can't really see. And he was as still as he possibly could, so he wouldn't get caught. And the owner wouldn't stay there that long. But then the owner started coughing and sneezing. And he needed... So the burglar, you know, was stuck in there for a while. So the only thing he thought of was actually there's a rag there. So he bunged it up his backside to plug it up so nothing would come out. He was desperate. And Ajahn Chah told a story, okay? I'm just repeating the great master. You know what's going to happen. And so the owner of the house was looking around there and his nose needed to be wiped. He saw the rag dangling down. And he pulled the rag and that's how the burglar got caught. This northeast Thai humour 50 years ago. Every time he's told that story, all these monks, I remember even Ajahn Liam, he's a tough monk, he just couldn't handle it. He was just holding his tummy, just laughing and groaning. But there was something about that which was just so simple and so beautiful. He didn't make up stories of like of hot dogs like I did the other day. Anyway, you asked for it, anyway. Ajahn Brahm, I noticed some fear rising in me today. What if I go home and slow down and stop striving? Will I stop being good at my job? I don't know what your job is. The not good enough complex has meant that I spent my life striving, overworking, constantly trying to learn more, develop my skills. It has often meant I've invested more time in work than with my family. How do I find the balance between learning, working, slowing down? You know, you do actually find that you're much more efficient at work when you know how to slow down. And, you know, that sometimes that people say, you know, why is it you're coming in or you're disappearing every now and again to do some meditation, but your work improves in quality. And we don't have the stress. You get more done. That's what I said of the Harvard Business School teaching about when you investment in time by learning how to rest during the day. Having half an hour's meditation somewhere. And it's also, you get the other part of slowing down, meditating, you do get more ideas, you become more innovative. See different ways of doing things. So actually, if you slow down and become more peaceful and find time to rest, don't, you know, you eat enough physical food, make sure the food for the heart is also eaten. And that means that you'll be wiser, healthier, and more innovative. And you'll become well regarded by your company. They'll probably ask you to teach them some meditation. Anyway, that's what I would do. Thank you again. That's what I do in my job. Thank you again for your great teachings, encouraging us to ask questions and your patience in interview time. Today I finally understood and experienced what you meant by let the breath come to you. Excellent. For the first time I had a taste of the delicious breath and felt the stillness and happiness come with it. You should have seen the big grin on my face after the meditation. Thank you again. Signed, Ajahn Brahm. No, I didn't write that. One of you did, so well done. And that's all the thanks which anyone needs. When something works and people like come up and say thank you and they say why they say thank you, that means so much. It's a job fulfillment thing. And you can imagine that sometimes some people have said to me and to others as well, each one of you and the sisters, the nuns, sometimes they said, you know, you saved my life. And they mean it. And that was one of the reasons why I don't mind teaching. There was, I was being an attendant at another monk's retreat years and years and years ago. And I was getting bored, just being attendant, listening to people all the time and say the same old things. And this lady came in and said, I just came in here to thank you for saving my life. And it was just so honest the way she was saying it. It just really woke me up. And then she explained what happened. They were doing this retreat in the north of Scotland, And they mention the eight precepts. And one of those precepts was not taking any alcohol or drugs. It wasn't explained very well, so she was taking Valium. She'd been taking that ever since she was at university. So she thought, oh my goodness, I can't take that anymore. So she stopped. It was very hard for her, but it was a very peaceful, supportive, safe place. So, you know, she survived the 9 days. In fact, she felt quite good. And then she decided, I've given it up for 9 days, why don't I give it up continually? Never take it again. And then, so she had to go through Glasgow railway station to get home. And she said that was just so difficult. She really came close to jumping on the tracks. But she managed to wait and get the joining train and go back home. She spent like a month sitting in a chair to, you know, get the Valium out of her system. She did that. You know, the eight precepts and the five precepts doesn't mean you don't take those drugs which have been prescribed by the doctors. I always say non-medicinal drugs. Don't take those. But anyway, after weaning herself off the Valium, then she said she had her life back again. She'd been like in a fog, in a mist, for so many years. And now she was mindful, aware again. Thank you for saving my life. When I heard that, wow, this monastic life can really help. And so I made a vow, that's what I want to do this for. Not just for your own wisdom and enlightenment, but to serve others. And of course, I'm sure each one of you have had that. People came up and say, thank you for saving my life. Remember that? I think you were my witness to this in Paddington Railway Station. And I think we're going off to a train to
Oxford,
yeah. And this lady came running up to me. She was Afro-English, and maybe about 25, 30 or something. She came up and said, look to me, you're the YouTube monk. That's what she called me. I said, yeah, you are. What are you doing here? She didn't let me speak. She just said, thank you for saving my life. When they say things like that, and they really mean it, she'd been going through a separation. It wasn't really a divorce. She hadn't committed in a ceremony, but she'd been with her partner for years. And they split up, and that really hurt her. And psychologists, psychiatrists never helped. But then she was on YouTube, and she just trolling through YouTube and got one of my talks, and then just continued listening to them. I think it was the Four Ways of Letting Go, I think she said. That's one of the most popular talks on YouTube. And she said, it healed me. I didn't want to commit suicide anymore. Thank you for saving my life. When someone says that to you, and they really mean it, imagine what that feels like. And you don't need to get any donations or $1 million or anything. Just, it comes from the heart and it means so much. So, I often say that monastic life, it is, oh, the job conditions are terrible. You have to work to all hours. You don't get paid. You don't get retirement benefits. Actually, you do get retirement. The eventual retirement benefits are out of this world. Okay. Could you please explain a bit more about the Kusina meditation? I think I did that this morning. Yeah. That's good. So the last question. It's 8:34. Have we got time to do the last question? No, let's leave it till tomorrow. Okay, here we go. You mentioned Ajahn Chah asking you why and then saying there's nothing. Can you please explain what he meant? He meant there's nothing. Do you understand? There's some things which you don't explain because that complicates things. You allow that answer to stay in your mind. And sometimes you're so peaceful and still, that answer just makes sense to you. There's nothing. my me or I. That's beautiful. The reason I said it is not for you to understand yet, but to stay in your mind so one day when the meditation gets really cool and very hot, no, I say cool and hot, same thing, very deep and very peaceful, those ideas come up and you understand them. You will explain it to yourself. No one else can. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Again, I do apologize for going over again. It's 8:36, but hopefully you found it useful. Thank you.